This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up in today's programme, a new bill is under consideration in the United States that will forbid civilians from weaponising drones, but it has one crucial exception, the police. We will be taking a look at the moral and legal concerns about policing by weaponised drones. With tensions between the UK and Spain mounting and the Royal Navy issuing direct warnings to Spanish naval vessels sailing in disputed waters of Gibraltar, will the escalating row over the British enclave undermine the Western military alliance of NATO, of which both Spain and Britain are members, or should the UK government accept the Spanish foreign minister's advice and calm down? Amid the many twists and turns that the French election campaign has taken, with the rise and fall of the scandal-ridden François Fillon and the emergence of the centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron, could there still be one last surprise in a rise of support for hard-left candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon? Members of the European Parliament have voted overwhelmingly in favour of the red lines for the Brexit negotiations put forward by the EU's chief Brexit negotiator Guy Verhofstadt. We'll be looking at what impact they'll have on the negotiations and what they may mean for the UK's post-Brexit future. And if you describe yourself as hangry, you're no longer speaking in slang as a slew of new words are officially added to the dictionary. All of that and more over the next hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. Drone attacks are often thought of as the concern of people in a faraway land or conflict zone, but Americans in the state of Connecticut may soon experience firsthand what it's like to have deadly drones flying above their cities. A new bill is being put together to prevent civilians from being able to weaponise their drones, but they will give an exception to the police. The bill will allow police officers in the state of Connecticut to use gun-mounted drones as well as non-lethal systems such as tasers and tear gas canisters. Currently, no state in the United States allows police forces to use deadly force by drones, but the state of North Dakota does allow officers to equip them with stun guns. The details of the bill are still being hammered out and is to be voted on in both chambers of the Connecticut legislature, but so far has passed smoothly through the first. Those who support the bill argue that officers will be trained adequately to use the drones, but civil liberties activists point to the fact that there is little to no domestic experience or precedent for the training to be based on. Critics of the bill have also argued that it is near impossible to put the necessary safeguards in place to protect civilians from attacks, and point to conflict zones where civilians are often killed, such as in Afghanistan, as an example of this. Well, for more, our correspondent Matthew Aiton caught up with Professor David Dunn from the Department of Political Science at Birmingham University, who's been focusing on the issue.
So this bill will reportedly be designed to allow the Connecticut Police Department to use weaponized drones. This sounds a bit hard to believe. Does it have precedent in the US or anywhere else, or will this be the first time?
The bill's very interesting. The bill talks in general terms about the need to prohibit the use of armed drones generally, and that's the main purpose of the bill. And that, I should think, shows the way in which there's concern about the technology being out there to arm drones. So that's the first thing, that legislation catching up with the technology that allows armed drones. The second aspect is that there has been precedent elsewhere, and that North Dakota has authorized the use of drones for non-lethal purposes, for use of things like tasers or indeed CS gas for policing purposes. The other precedent, I suppose, is the use of a land robot, actually a modified bomb disposal truck device that was used in Dallas, actually to lethal effect. They put a hand grenade on a bomb disposal vehicle, drove it up around a wall, and they blew up a shooter who was firing on police. So in a sense, the idea of an unmanned system being used to lethal effect in a police situation has a precedent from the Dallas case. What will be new entirely, in this case in Connecticut, is the use of an aerial vehicle potentially for deadly purposes, in the domestic sense, of course. I mean, obviously, there has been the use of predators and reapers, military drones, used outside the United States by Britain and America in the Middle East and in Africa. And what's interesting here is that a lot of the criticism that have been forwarded towards the use of Predator and Reaper in those countries is that they blur the distinction between the use of military force and the use of military force or lethal force for law enforcement purposes, and that they have been targeted terrorists and even American citizens who are terrorists. But rather than trying to arrest them and bring them to justice because of their alleged role in terrorism, what they've done and the use of Predator and Reaper is to use lethal force against them wherever they may be.
Republican Senator John Kissel has said that, quote, we can certainly envision some incident on some campus or somewhere where someone is a rogue shooter or someone was kidnapped and you can try to blow out a tire. What do you think could possibly go wrong with this?
Well, again, what he's referring to there, I think, is the Dallas precedent, whereby a rogue shooter who's firing on someone, and the legal justification would have to be that there was an imminent threat presented by that shooter, and therefore the use of armed force and potentially lethal force could be used against them in those circumstances. So I think he's referring to that in a wider sense. And then he goes off at the end to talk about blowing out a tire. And again, that would ostensibly be non-lethal force. But of course, if you're shooting out someone's tire, that can have a lethal consequence if the vehicle then crashes with a deadly effect. Now, there are many things that can go wrong with this. And the not least the association with drones, whereby there may be a quicker resort to the use of force once removed at a distance, which is one of the allegations against the use of drones overseas in these circumstances. One of the things that in the UK police force that they're very keen to stress is that the police force are about negotiating situations down, about actually the citizen in uniform being involved in trying to defuse a situation. And you know, because they're not armed, they have to use negotiating tactics to actually deal with all the situations. By contrast, in America, where there's an armed police force, there was a culture of force protection. There was a culture of actually being so concerned of being shot that they shoot first, and that therefore you know, there are many, many more deaths. And of course, you know, the whole question of who force is used against and what circumstances is highly politicized, and the whole race element comes into that. And you can imagine that the added technological dimension to that making that situation potentially worse.
Yes, that ties in nicely with what I wanted to ask you next. Police officers in Connecticut are required by law to document all taser use, and in 2016 a report found that officers used the weapons disproportionately against minorities, especially African Americans. Is there a concern that these drones might be misused in this way too, would you say?
I'm sure the American Civil Liberties organizations would see that as a concern because there is a disproportionate use of force by white policemen against black suspects, and you know, that there is a ongoing issue of race in American law and order, and the use of tasering and the use of lethal force is disproportionately higher, you know, when it's white on black as opposed to any other combination. So yes, I think that the potential use of drones for tasering or for armed use of a lethal nature would add to be a dimension to that debate too.
Is the use of these drones, if you can answer this, against American citizens on American soil, legally justifiable?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting case that the military are prohibited to use our lethal force on American soil. But what's interesting here is that this is a dimension coming up from the law enforcement organizations, from police forces. And in a sense, as we think about the drone revolution, the access to the air that drones now afford in a way that wasn't possible before, you've got to think of these things as having two parents, the parents of the drone, that is. One is the armed aircraft that became unpiloted, so the big things like Reaper and Predator. But on the other hand, the origin of these things comes from model aircraft that have got more sophisticated as a consequence of mobile phone technology being incorporated into these small drones. This mobile drone technology in the form of longer battery life, sophisticated cameras, the ability to actually transmit that data over distance, and fast processors that allow these things to operate and create a stable platform to operate from. So what that does is create a new opportunity for police forces. And we already know that police are using these things in surveillance operations. They're using these things to actually get tactical advantage by seeing behind a building, behind a wall, see above a suspect. We know also the criminals are using these drones in the same way. And therefore, what we're doing is, in a sense of seeing, what we're seeing is policing and the dynamic nature of policing against potential perpetrators, adopting and incorporating new technology in the way in which they approach each other. And this requires clear legal and ethical scrutiny, because this is in danger, if you're not careful, being presented as a technical extension of existing policing. But of course, it's important to recognise where you're crossing ethical and judicial lines in that process.
Some might say that the potential deployment of such weaponry against civilians looks like the behaviour of a burgeoning police state. Is that just hyperbole, or is it a statement that you would agree with in this case?
I mean, I think that the fact that we're discussing this now, the fact that there's in media coverage of this and the scrutiny and debate in the American and international press demonstrates that this is not something which is being adopted without debate. I think, however, that what is likely to happen, given the ripeness of this technology, is that many police forces around the world will adopt this technology and perhaps use it in this way. And it may well be the case that this is an effective tool for repressive regimes and police states. Whether I don't think you can necessarily at this stage to describe America in those terms, but the technological development does present that possibility for the future.
And finally, drone attacks and their consequences are something we usually hear about from a distance of oceans and continents away. Do you think this signifies the start of a kind of drone warfare being brought to our own shores here in the West?
The reason why this bill is being discussed at all, rather than the clause with regard to the potential use by police of drones, is to try and to attempt to limit the arming of drones by civilians, by criminals, and make it a criminal offence, so that if anyone does that, there's a legal redress and a legal route to prosecute people from that. So there's clearly a concern from the get-go about drones being armed and used in criminal purposes. And they are, in many respects, an ideal weapon for crime. They are ideal in terms of the surveillance, the scoping, to use an Americanism, the casing out the joint, as it were, of reconnaissance and surveillance to actually plan burglary or murder. They're an ideal murder weapon. It's very easy to fit a handgun or an explosive device to a drone that can be used in a way that actually can give you distance, give you security, give you anonymity to carry out a crime, to leave no forensic footprint other than the projectile used for the crime to be returned back to the user. Even if it's shot out the sky, there's no way of tracing the owner from the downed drone. So what they are is a perfect murder weapon for individuals, for gangs, for whoever it might be. The same what's true of ordinary murder is also true potentially for terrorism. And we've seen the use by IS in Iraq and Syria of drones that they modify and build themselves, which have been used to great effect to actually kill people with precision over extended distances. The fact that you can have real-time relays of imagery back to your mobile phone or iPad means that actually these are a new weapon, giving a new access to the air, giving us a three-dimensional access to a battlefield that was only available at very expensive cost before through this technology.
Okay, Professor David Dunn, thanks for talking to us here on World in Focus.
Okay.
Breaking news, expert analysis, and exclusive stories all in one place. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on the programme, we will be looking at the mounting tensions between the UK and Spain and what impact it could have, if any, on NATO. More on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
I'm Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Tune in!
Well, maybe mention like central bankers and you know, markets are doubling down. Not you're saying everybody's doubling down, they're crazy.
They are! Everyone's crazy!
Tom Hartman.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik. Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme. With tensions between the UK and Spain mounting and the Royal Navy issuing direct warnings to Spanish naval vessels sailing in disputed waters off Gibraltar, will the escalating row over the British enclave undermine the Western military alliance of NATO, of which both Spain and Britain are members? Or should the UK government accept the Spanish Foreign Minister's advice and calm down? Amid the many twists and turns that the French election campaign has taken, with the rise and fall of the scandal-ridden François Fillon and the emergence of the centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron, could there still be one last surprise in a rise of support for hard-left candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon? And if you describe yourself as hangry, you're no longer speaking in slang, as a slew of new words are officially added to the dictionary. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It is 16 minutes past the hour. Gunboat diplomacy is not normally the behaviour you would expect from two countries that are full members of the same military alliance. But tensions are continuing to rise between Spain and the UK, both members of NATO, after the EU ruled Spain could veto any final Brexit deal with Britain if the Spanish are refused a voice over the future of Gibraltar. Our reporter Mark Kirst has been looking at the latest incident to have stoked tensions between the two countries.
The British Foreign Office has taken the unprecedented step of issuing a statement defending a challenge the Royal Navy issued to a Spanish patrol boat, the Infanta Cristina, that entered disputed waters off the coast of Gibraltar yesterday. Spain and the UK are both members of the military alliance, NATO, and Spanish naval vessels are presently taking part in a joint NATO exercise in UK waters off the coast of Scotland. But the latest incident comes amid growing tensions between the two countries, after the EU ruled Spain would hold a veto on any Brexit deal negotiated if Spain was denied a voice over the future of the British enclave situated on the southern tip of the Iberian Peninsula. The robust Royal Navy response also comes just days after former Conservative Party leader Michael Howard suggested UK Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May could go to war with Spain if Gibraltar's sovereignty was threatened. Whilst the tensions have resulted in widespread coverage in the UK mainstream media, the Spanish response has been more tempered, with Spain's Foreign Minister Alfonso Dastíez urging the UK to, quote, calm down. So might this growing rift even threaten the future that both countries play in NATO? Well, joining me now is Dr. Duncan Wheeler, Associate Professor in Spanish Studies at Leeds University. Dr. Wheeler, the British press appear to have gone into meltdown over the perceived possibility that Spain may try and reassert its sovereignty over Gibraltar. The Spanish media response by comparison has been very much muted. How much does this issue of sovereignty over Gibraltar bear on the minds of ordinary Spaniards?
I think it doesn't bear on the minds of all. It depends on what you'd describe ordinary Spaniards. I think there's a small vocal minority for whom it's a major issue in everyday life, far more so than people in the UK. But I think a lot of people are just bored with the issue in Spain. I mean, this has been curious what's happened over the last few days, because traditionally Gibraltar's always been a much bigger issue in the Spanish media than in the UK media. Former Prime Minister Felipe González famously described Gibraltar as a stone in Spain's shoe. And I think maybe here it's become an issue because, and even Brexit was such a big issue in the Spanish media. I wonder if here it's so much because Lord Howard's come out and made these statements, which almost feel like a kind of somewhat, you know, reality TV star and a desperate plums for further celebrity to me.
And have people in Spain been surprised by the kind of British media and political backlash over the issue of Gibraltar?
I don't think particularly. I think they, and I think there's also people in Spain who are very, very annoyed at their own government. for kind of their opportunistic manoeuvrings and a wide variety of issues. And I think for them, they're likely to see this as yet another example of that.
And we've had this incursion by a Spanish naval vessel into Gibraltarian waters.
Yes.
Given Spain and the UK are both NATO members, in fact, they're both training together at the moment, isn't this a storm in a teacup and will only serve to damage and potentially undermine Spanish and UK relations?
Yes, and I mean, the other issue, of course, with is Spanish vessels have gone into UK waters repeatedly around Gibraltar and haven't normally led to this kind, you know, haven't normally it's kind of caused annoyance, frustration, but haven't actually led to this kind of, you know, more official confrontation. And I think it can just be damaging. It's just going to be damaging for our relations. But having said that, I mean, I think it's been in some senses, it's been an attempt by other European stakeholders to stop Spain from vetoing wider debates, because I think what this does is it basically concentrates Spain's attention on one very specific issue and gives them some level of sovereignty over the issue of trade deals, which could have an effect on sovereignty.
And is there any sense of exacerbation with the British on the Spanish side that potentially or that perhaps they view the British as being obsessed with their former imperial history, and that perhaps after Brexit Europe might be a far better place?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that. I mean, of course, Spain is also obsessed with its former imperial history. There's a real sense of when I was in, I remember when I went to Spain, I was in Spain just after the referendum. And there was this kind of, there was a mixture of just consternation of how can people, you know, why can British people vote against this, to just this kind of, well, if they don't want to be part of it, they don't want to be part of it.
There are hundreds of thousands of British expats living in Spain. Do these media and politically motivated tensions have any effect on relations between ordinary Brits and Spaniards living together in the same community?
Well, you say living together in the same communities. I mean, there obviously are instances where that's happening, but an awful lot of the British residents who, you know, living in or UK residents living in Spain actually live effectively in their own ghettos or however you want to describe it, and don't actually have that much to do with Spaniards on an everyday basis. I have to say, I mean, I've just come back from Barcelona and there was no sense of people being annoyed with me personally, although you do sometimes get these sort of comments of, well, you're very nice for a British person, which is kind of damning with but not sometimes actually get attributed to the fact I'm half Scottish, but I guess, you know, that's why you're sociable and nice.
And how much awareness is there that at a political level in Spain that this kind of hyped rhetoric from the British is aimed primarily at a domestic audience in the UK that remains deeply divided over Brexit?
I don't think that's getting through. I mean, it's strange that it's not getting through, because a similar sort of dynamic happened all the time in Spanish politics. But I've actually been surprised that it hasn't blown up more in Spain than it has done, to be honest.
Dr. Duncan Wheeler, Associate Professor in Spanish Studies at Leeds University. Many thanks for joining us today on World in Focus.
Thank you very much.
Well, we contacted both the UK Foreign Office and NATO for a response to this incident. The UK government refused to answer questions over whether the row was undermining both countries' role in NATO. NATO told Radio Sputnik that the issue was a bilateral one and refused to answer questions over whether NATO would mediate between the two opposing sides. So in the meantime, it looks likely that tensions will continue until the Brexit process is complete and both sides agree a definitive position over the future of Gibraltar. Mark Hurst, World in Focus.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
You are listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 23 minutes past the hour. Last night saw a political debate of quite epic proportions as 11 candidates for the French elections took part in a four-hour televised debate. Of course, all eyes were on the top five candidates, as we discussed in length on yesterday's show, but perhaps the most talked-about aspect of the debate was the apparent success of the hard-left candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Polling after the debate saw Mélenchon came out as the most convincing candidate. That's according to a survey of 1,024 viewers in an ELIB poll for BFM TV. Mélenchon won over around 25% of those polled, putting him 4 points ahead of centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron, who came in second at 21%. Front National's far-right leader Marine Le Pen came fourth in the post-debate polling on who was most convincing, winning over only 11% of those polled. But this poll is, of course, based on who was most impressive in the debate and is not necessarily reflective of voting intentions across France. Mélenchon has made gains in first-round polling, edging very close to becoming the third-place candidate, catching up on Republicans' scandal hit Françoise Fillon. To get a better idea of what Mélenchon's recent rise in the polls might mean, earlier today I spoke to Dr. Paul Smith, Associate Professor in French and Francophone Studies at the University of Nottingham. Now, it was a fairly epic debate last night. 4 hours is a long time to be paying attention to political debate. Did you watch the whole thing yourself, Paul?
I watched the very beginning of it, but I have to confess that it coincided with my bedtime, so I didn't watch the whole debate, but I caught up with it now this morning.
I don't think anybody could possibly judge you on not watching the whole 4 hours. Now, the polling after the debate suggests that Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the hard left candidate, came out looking very good in the debate. And when Benoît Hamon won the primaries for the Socialists, someone suggested that the only real way that the left could unite was for Mélenchon and his supporters to get behind Hamon. But it seems that the tables have turned. Is there some pressure now on the Socialists to accept that Mélenchon is perhaps the strongest candidate from the left?
Well, there might be some pressure, but they won't give in to that. Mm. What has happened is the left is very clearly divided. Hamon is the Socialist Party candidate, and the Socialist Party apparatus, as it were, will not roll around and support Mélenchon. And I don't think Mélenchon wants that. He wants to use this election, and indeed the general election that follows it, as a way of breaking the Socialist Party and forcing the left, former socialists and what have you, whatever's left of that, to rally to his cause. So I don't think that there's no love lost between Mélenchon and the socialists, and I don't think that he would give in and kind of become the socialist leader and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. And despite there not being a desire within the socialist establishment to back Mélenchon, is there a chance that he could reach the kind of tipping point in the polls where voters that would traditionally vote for the socialists might think, well, Benoît Hamon doesn't seem to have much of a chance, maybe we should shift to Mélenchon just to put up a left-wing candidate?
I think we've already seen that. I mean, if you look at you're quite right. If you look at the way the opinion polls have gone, initially Hamon, when he won the primary, overtook Mélenchon, because we should remember that when the primaries were going on, they were only talking about Hamon getting 6% of the vote, and then he won the primary, shot past Mélenchon to 14, 15%. Mélenchon dropped to 10, but that's been flipped round, and Mélenchon seems to be on the move. And I think what's happened there is that there's been a shift amongst some socialist voters, those on the left of the party, people who've kind of said, well, you know, we can't vote Hamon, he's not a serious candidate, so it looks like we'll shift our vote to Mélenchon. So I think we're already seeing that in the way that certainly the opinion polls are playing out.
Mm-hmm. Now, one candidate that didn't do as well as some might have expected last night was Marine Le Pen of Front National. Only 11% of those viewing who were polled said that they thought she came out on top. But of course, that's just a poll of the viewers, not of the French public. Is there a chance, though, we might see some kind of shock over the next 2 weeks where perhaps Mélenchon manages to become a candidate that could go up against Macron?
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think there are quite enough votes on the left to push him there. I mean, I think what happened to Le Pen last night is that there's been a lot of talk about this, that, of course, the let's say lesser candidates, that's a bit impolite, but the other candidates are much more radical in some ways than she is, and actually their presence and their arguments made her actually look, oddly enough, like part of the establishment. That was a really unexpected aspect of what happened last night. Now, it may well be that Mélenchon, you know, got a big boost last night, but I can't see, well, it'd be interesting to see what the overall scores are by the end of the week in terms of popularity. I can't quite see him creeping that close and being the candidate to challenge Macron. What will be interesting, and this has been the sort of background noise for a couple of weeks now, is if he's able to overtake Fillon, because if he becomes the third place candidate, then we really are looking at something quite significant for the presidential election, but also the way it plays out afterwards in the general election on the 11th and 18th of June.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we speak of Marine Le Pen as being the anti-establishment candidate, but Mélenchon in many ways also represents an anti-establishment vote. He isn't the Eurosceptic that Marine Le Pen is, though he is a Eurosceptic in many ways that are more left-wing. He's against the kind of austerity of the EU. We also, you know, after Donald Trump's inauguration, we saw these massive women's marches across the globe, and this kind of feeling that the left had to start doing something. Is that something that's likely to now maybe rally behind Mélenchon and see more of these demonstrations of the left trying to bring a more anti-establishment left to the forefront?
Yes, I think that's already there. I mean, that one of the things that turned his fortune and Mélenchon's fortunes around was a massive rally on the 18th of March, which marked the anniversary of his real appearance on the scene in 2012. You know, and it's also harking back to a historic left-wing date in French history, the declaration of the Commune of 1871. And 120,000 people, according to organisers, but certainly over 100,000 went out and demonstrated in support of him. So he is anti-establishment. He's against the EU in the sense that he sees the EU as having failed to deliver a social space, that it's become a free market space, but it doesn't protect the interests of workers. And that's very much his brand of Euroscepticism. He's anti-globalization in a kind of, Bernie Sanders isn't anti-EU by definition, but that kind of left-wing critique of the failures of globalization and the failure of the EU is very much part of the Mélenchon thing. So there is a groundswell of opinion. But of course, one of the things that Mélenchon is trying to do in some ways is seize back working class voters who've defected to Le Pen, because a lot of the, you know, she's the leading candidate amongst the blue collar working class in France.
Mm-hmm. Now, it has been quite a roller coaster of a campaign, really, for all candidates. We've seen these scandals hit Fillon and lead to Macron taking a better lead over Fillon. But it strikes me that a lot of people today seem quite surprised that Mélenchon has managed to gain this support. Is it not a little bit inevitable that in the current climate, a left-wing anti-establishment figure who is similar to the likes of Bernie Sanders would do reasonably well?
Yes, I think that there's a certain inevitability about it. And what I'm thinking as I look at it is that last time round, he was a candidate in 2012, and we had a similar phenomenon. There was this big demonstration that I mentioned earlier. There was this kind of, the French talked about it as being a kind of what they called Mélenchonitis. The French term was Mélenchonite, and this kind of media kind of bandwagon that got behind him and his success, and everybody thought, wow, Mélenchon, he could actually beat Le Pen. You know, back in 2012, we were talking about beating her into third place. And that kind of, it looked to be on the cards. And then that kind of fell away, partly because Mélenchon reined himself in, because, of course, there was a serious left-wing contender in 2012 in the shape of Hollande. And Mélenchon was a little bit worried himself about scaring too many moderates away, because, you know, the context of 2012 is that we want anybody but Sarkozy. We're in a very different, you know, it's a very different environment now, and you can compare elections in some ways, and of course in other ways they're completely, you know, it's impossible to compare them. So, but I am a little wary of this kind of electoral bandwagon, the idea that Mélenchon is the coming man. We need to kind of handle that with care. But also, we can, you know, we look at his vote, the people who are intending to vote for him and people who intend to vote for Amon. We are looking at 25, you know, when you add those up, that's still a big chunk of the electorate in a four-horse race. So, you know, if enough Amon voters do defect, he could still be a serious player, but I don't think he'll quite get enough to get him into the second round. But yes, absolutely, I would, you know, you would expect a kind of left-wing critique to be emerging from the conditions. As you say, you talked about Bernie Sanders, and that's exactly what you would, and of course, we'll be looking at it in Germany with Schulz and that kind of critique, that left-wing critique of the EU and of Merkel.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, it's a pleasure speaking to you. As always, thank you very much for joining us on World in Focus.
My very great pleasure.
Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up in the programme, members of the European Parliament have voted overwhelmingly in favour of the red lines for the Brexit negotiations put forward by the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Guy Verhofstadt. We will be looking at what impact they might have on the negotiations and what they might mean for the UK's post-Brexit future. More on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House.
Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com. Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@SputnikNews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, members of the European Parliament have voted overwhelmingly in favour of the red lines for the Brexit negotiations put forward by the EU's Brexit negotiator, Guy Verhofstadt. We'll be looking at what impact they will have on the negotiations and what they might mean for the UK's post-Brexit future. And if you describe yourself as hangry, you are no longer speaking in slang, as a slew of new words are officially added to the dictionary. Members of the European Parliament in Strasbourg have drawn up battle plans for the forthcoming negotiations on Britain's exit from the EU, Brexit. Phrases like Europe's citizens come first, the EU is not for sale, and that the UK cannot take EU citizens hostage were all prominent as red lines were drawn ahead of the start of talks today. Jack Foster has more.
The European Parliament in Strasbourg represents the largest transnational electorate in the world at around 375 million people. It goes, therefore, without saying that it faces a busy 2 years ahead, with the terms of the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the bloc needing to meet with the approval of its 751 constituencies effectively before the end of 2018. It was in that spirit that MEPs held a debate today on the supposed red lines for Brexit negotiations from the EU side. In short, they comprise the rejection of any trade-offs on security, protecting the rights of EU citizens inside and outside of a post-Brexit UK, and perhaps most contentious of all, the need for some sort of financial settlement from the UK government. It was, at points, a fiery debate. For example, Nigel Farage, former leader of the pro-Brexit UKIP party, was true to form, reprising his well-rehearsed Eurosceptic bombast, even comparing the European Union to the mafia.
Already you've made a series of demands that are not just unreasonable, but in some cases clearly impossible for Britain to comply with. You began by telling us that we have to pay a bill, a cool 52 billion sterling, a figure that has clearly been plucked out of the air, effectively a form of ransom demand. We're actually shareholders in this building and the rest of the assets, and really, you should be making us an offer we can't refuse to go. You've shown yourselves with these demands to be vindictive, to be nasty. All I can say is thank goodness we're leaving. You're behaving like the mafia. You think we're a hostage. We're not. We're free to go.
Former leader of the UK's pro-Brexit UKIP party, Nigel Farage, speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. Leader of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe group, Guy Verhofstadt, an old adversary of Mr. Farage, raised a familiar refrain which came to define a lot of the debate: the need to prioritise the needs of UK and EU citizens over and above politicking.
What is clear in this debate is let's put the citizens first. And it doesn't make any difference when it are EU citizens or UK citizens. We will be firm, we need to be firm, to defend the unity and the interest of the European towards the UK authorities. But my appeal here in the House today is to be open, positive, generous towards the UK citizens, because many of them, millions of them, want to keep their relationship, their link, their identity on the European level.
Leader of the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe group, Guy Verhofstadt, speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. And Dutch centre-right MEP Esther de Lange spoke about the legacy of the European Union in maintaining peace and the need to maintain a relationship between the UK and EU post-Brexit.
In a couple of weeks, I will take my six-year-old son to London for the first time. And he will see the cenotaph, and I will tell him about the bravery of those men who fought in two European wars and to whom we will be eternally grateful. But he will not understand, because thank God he has never known war. Although not too far away from here, and you can laugh, but not too far away from here, children his age and younger are dying in the poisonous clouds of Idlib, the same clouds that we saw over Flanders fields a century ago. And it's for those generations of young Europeans, those born after the fall of the Berlin Wall, that the remaining 27 member states need to stand united and together and work at a reformed and stronger European Union. And it is for those young generations of Brits that we need a fair deal and a continued relationship with the United Kingdom, because they did not vote to leave. And let us, dear colleagues, politicians of this very old continent, show the young people in Britain and in Europe alike that Europe is not a place of hate, of pettiness, or of revenge, but we can learn the lessons of the past and reshape a future in which the negotiating table will always, always prevail over outright conflict.
Esther de Lange, MEP of the Dutch centre-right, speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. Questions over the economic implications of Brexit also came up, and Danish socialist MEP Jeppe Kofod wanted reassurances that the EU would be protected from being drawn into what he termed a race to the bottom with the post-Brexit United Kingdom, but also the need to look out for those inside the UK who are not supporting Brexit.
Brexit will be the most difficult, costly, unnecessary divorce in history. In the coming months and years, the EU27 and the UK government will end up in any number of catfights we can expect. But let me be crystal clear. Whatever the cost, whatever the hassle, whatever the differences of opinions, this Parliament will serve the citizens of Europe, period. We are their directly elected voice. We will be their strongest defender, their best advocate in this and its ally. This goes for EU citizens and for UK citizens. We will not allow the Brexiters' broken promises, half-truths and even lies to harm the citizens of the UK and EU any more than they already have done. To the citizens of the 27 remaining member states, I say, we will never allow a post-Brexit UK to undermine your rights and conditions by competing in a race to the bottom. And to the citizens of the UK, I say, we will continue to fight for your best interest, and we will keep a seat for you at our table.
Jeppe Kofod, MEP, Danish socialist, speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. The Latvian MEP, Robert Zile, vice chair of the European Conservatives and Reformists, tried to strike a more conciliatory note and called on his European colleagues for calm in the upcoming negotiations.
We will only speak about the future relationships when we settle on accounts. We are the champions, but those are the other sides are the losers. We will not leave them any single cherry of the cake. That was a sum of statements which was here also today in the chamber and also in the media. I would like to ask colleagues to calm down. Does anybody believe that in the negotiations there will be winners when it comes to citizens' rights issues? Indeed, how successful can we recall arrangement where part of the success is achieved by discriminating against the citizens of the other EU nation? Or take business that are the backbone of economies. Do we really want to extend uncertainties for next 5 years or even more years? It is possible within the next 2 years to settle the past accounts and work on the comprehensive framework for the future relationships. This treaty allows, and the business wait for that, and at the end, European people want it.
Robert Zile, MEP, Vice Chair of European Conservatives and Reformists, speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. And as the debate neared its conclusion, the earlier comments by Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party, those ones where he compared the EU to the mafia, found themselves referenced more than a few times. Belgian Green MEP Philippe Lamberts, for example, called Farage's comments nonsense, and that for sense to prevail, colleagues should simply ignore them. He also went on to argue that there could be no winners from Brexit.
Brexit is a lose-lose game. I would have much preferred for us to stick together, l'union fait la force, we say in Belgium, and that remains the case today. But there's one thing where I believe no compromise is possible, and that's the only thing that really annoyed me in Mrs. May's letter. It's about security cooperation. Security cooperation is an area where we cannot let a lose-lose logic prevail. It is in the interest of the safety and security of all our citizens, British or otherwise, to cooperate deeply in matters of security. And what we cannot accept is that any other kind of consideration, trade, commercial, whatever, stands in the way. There's no trade-off here. It goes about the lives of men and women.
Belgian Green MEP Philippe Lamberts speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. And UKIP's Nigel Farage popped up again towards the end of the debate when he raised once more the thorny issue of the so-called final bill for Brexit.
Why, in a spirit of good neighbourliness, would you pluck this bizarre figure of 52 billion sterling out of the air that you say is our final settlement payment? Remember one thing. From the moment we voted Brexit to the moment we leave, we will net have put £30 billion into this European Union, and you want another 50. It just doesn't work. For any negotiation in life to work, both sides stake out a position. Both sides ask for more than they realistically expect to get. I understand that. But you've gone so far with this that it's just impossible for us to see any accommodation. I think there needs to be give and take on both sides. And I think if you gave on the money and you gave on Gibraltar, then what I would like to see the United Kingdom government doing is saying there are 3.3 million EU citizens living in the UK. They all came to Britain legally, and we will now unilaterally guarantee their rights for the future. Both sides need to give on this for any sensible deal to come out of it. We can walk away without a deal. It'll hurt European workers and European companies more than us. But surely it makes sense for both of us to come to a sensible accommodation.
Nigel Farage, the former leader of the UK's pro-Brexit UKIP party, speaking there during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. But it wasn't for those comments that Nigel Farage would be remembered today. Rather, it was that insinuation that the European Union was behaving akin to the mafia, which we heard earlier on, that had gotten under the skin of a lot of MEPs, including Vicky Ford of the UK's governing Conservative Party, who raised this point of order in the chamber.
Calling other colleagues members of the mafia or gangsters does not show mutual respect. It does not represent the views of the vast majority of the British people, and it is not the view of the British Prime Minister, who wants to remain friends, allies and partners. Thank you.
Vicky Ford of the UK's governing Conservative Party raising a point of order in reference to comments made by UKIP's Nigel Farage during this morning's debate in the European Parliament. President of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, brought the debate to a close with some strong words which also referenced those comments from the UKIP benches.
The Parliament will play a key role during these negotiations. It will have a vote at the end, either in favor or against, respecting the rules of democracy. In this chamber, there are 751 members of parliament representing 500 million European citizens. All are properly elected. There are no mafia here, and there are no gangsters here. There are only representatives of the people. This has nothing to do with national sensitivity. It's all about being civil and democratic.
President of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, drawing to a close this morning's debate on the so-called red lines on the EU side in negotiations with the UK on Brexit. Now, there are few people on this earth who understand the twists and the turns of the European Union better than Sputnik's very own Jim Ensom, and thankfully he's on hand now to dig a little deeper into this morning's debate. Jim, what were these red lines then?
The phrase that kept coming up over and again was citizens first, and it was being made quite clear that whatever the outcome of Brexit, the Parliament would put citizens first and the rights of them and their obligations towards them would be exactly the same. What's critical about that is that one of the central points is the rights of EU workers working in the UK and what happens to them after Brexit, as well as, of course, British citizens in EU countries. And it's quite clear to me, listening to all the debate and to Guy Verhofstadt and Tajani, they were all saying, look, whatever happens, the citizens have got to come first in whatever agreement. Now, the other red lines were the negotiating principles must be transparent and open. Well, I suppose they've got to say that, really. No hard border with Northern Ireland came up a few times. And the important thing was that whatever happens, Britain has to pay for its obligations first. In other words, everything that Britain is committed to, all the financial arrangements, treaties and documents signed that have a financial obligation in the years to come, those must all be signed off, and the exit bill will be talked about first before anything can be discussed on a new free trade agreement. But on that particular point, they say you're not going to interfere with the four freedoms of the EU. That's the free movement of people, services, goods, and capital. And in saying that, that goes to the heart of the Brexit negotiations. It was all about controlling immigration into the UK and the way you control EU workers. And what they were saying is, whatever you do, you cannot interfere with the four freedoms. And if you want to trade with us in the future, the four freedoms come with it.
Now, one of the things which came up today quite a few times and has particularly angered a lot of people on the EU side of the Brexit talks, for what they are so far, is the issue of security. There have been suggestions from the UK government that this might be a bargaining position, how much they might share security information and so on with the EU. Although on the European side, there seems to be an attitude of this is just not something that can be up for negotiation. I wonder if we could just unpack that a little.
It's very, very complicated. The fact of the matter is, and this is hard talk from the parliamentarians, the fact of the matter is Britain's background in intelligence gathering and security and counter-terrorism is pretty well second to none. The attacks in Paris and in Brussels and to a certain extent in Germany all expose the fact that intelligence on people travelling throughout Europe and on criminals and on terrorist groups was actually failing. And it was indeed on one occasion that it was Britain's own intelligence services that helped out the French police in the Paris attacks. And, of course, Rob Wainwright, who's a Brit, a very senior British policeman, he's in charge of Europol. And Britain, including in Theresa May's letter to Donald Tusk, has been saying, look, security is a major issue and it will be under discussion. And there is behind it a threat that if we don't get, if Britain doesn't get its way on a free trade agreement, it may remove itself from cooperation on security issues. And coming from a NATO member, with many NATO members in the EU, this is a very significant bargaining chip. And what they were doing today was saying, no, you can't. You can't cherry-pick bits of which you want to join, and you can't say, you know, if you want to be part of the free trade agreement, security comes part and parcel of it, and you can't use the threat to withdraw as a bargaining chip in the negotiations. That's why security is an issue.
There also seemed to be a lot of talk in the debate today about the idea that this was effectively playing with people's lives.
Very much so. The suggestion being made that you were, I heard the word hostage being used, that effectively in any deal over security, we were holding EU citizens to hostage over the matter of security. These are tough words, Jack, I can tell you. It's not surprising at the start of any round of talks, you draw up these so-called red lines. But you know as well as I do that the history of the EU is a history of fudges, fudge and fix. Because ultimately, at the end of it, pragmatism's got to prevail. I mean, the Northern Ireland question, for instance, and I mean, that's a matter of security as well. But in order to keep the border open with Northern Ireland and all the delicate Northern Ireland peace process and the Good Friday Agreement that goes with that, that's an enormously complicated political issue. What they're saying is that whatever happens, you've got to keep open the border with Northern Ireland. And how that goes together with an in-out of the single market, I'm not quite sure how they're going to resolve that.
Now, obviously, we've already heard the clips of Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party, the pro-Brexit party in the United Kingdom, speaking today and making all sorts of controversial statements about the EU being gangsters and so on. But there was something which he said towards the end of the debate in his closing remarks where, and I hesitate to say this, he almost sounded reasonable. I'm being hesitant in saying that, but he was talking about the free movement of people and, more importantly, about EU citizens who are currently living inside of the UK. He seemed to be suggesting that were there to be no fine levied against the UK, that he would be happy with the idea that everyone who is an EU citizen who is currently in the UK could just stay. No questions
asked. I think that's typical bluster from the politician, as usual, because the fact of the matter is the British negotiating position is that the fine that he was talking about, which is the exit payment for getting out of our obligations, there is a sum of money. It's been bandied around sort of somewhere in the field of 60 billion euros. The negotiating position on Britain is that there is agreement that there must be some payment for what we're obliged to pay, and that will go. And in putting it together, in Farage attempted to put that together with the rights of EU workers, is a very difficult one, because the fact of the matter is Britain's position is that EU workers' rights will be protected, whatever happens. Mm. How many of those rights, we don't know. And secondly, Britain's position is that it does have to pay something to leave the EU, but they want a written list of how they reach that figure. So Farage, as usual, is coming from left field on this particular one, and in trying to put those two together, I think he's going to have a great deal of difficulty. Yes, he did sound a little bit sympathetic, but in all honesty, he's not leading the negotiations.
Well, no, this is true. And of course, it's all intertwined somewhat with the freedom of movement issue. How is that going to affect the talks?
It's going to be central to it, to be quite frank with you, because the mandate that Theresa May has got was really centred on the referendum, which was all about immigration and the need to bring back borders to the BBC, to the UK. And the reality is, Britain is already not a member of Schengen, so it already does have border controls. But the question is, what about foreign workers coming to Britain? A lot of people voted to get out simply because they were fed up with, as it were, their phrase, not mine, foreigners coming over here and taking our jobs. Mm. And that is why the issue is so sensitive. It's political hot potato for Theresa May, and it's difficult to square that with the freedom of movement. Now, there is the Luxembourg Convention. Luxembourg is a member of the EU, trades with the EU, but it has limits on immigration in sectors. And I fail to see how the Luxembourg opt-out on freedoms of movement cannot be used in negotiations over Brexit. And I think that will be one of the options looked at.
Jim Ensom, thank you. Sputnik's own Jim Ensom there. And so, in the end, the European Parliament backed the motion setting out its Brexit negotiation position by 516 to 133 votes. And whilst MEPs will not actually be involved directly in the talks between Europe and the UK, they will be required to approve whatever final deal is reached. That, of course, assumes that a deal will be reached by the March 2019 deadline, which is now looming inexorably closer as the Brexit clock ticks on towards the day that Britain leaves the European Union. Just how shiny the good ship Brexit looks by then is anyone's guess. Jack Foster, World in Focus.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and finally for today, every now and then the dictionary gets an update, often to the upset of many language purists, and now the dictionary includes a few new slang words, such as hangry, which apparently means you're angry because you were hungry. Friendiversary is now also been added, of course defined as the anniversary you became friends with someone, now more obvious with the popularity of social media sites. It's not all just slang words though. The phrase cat cafe is now in the dictionary, as is mic drop and man bun. And that is all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen again to this and to all previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we will be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartmann Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold.
Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
black mayor, black chief of police, I would say the thing that is missing is a black middle class who actually have good manufacturing jobs in the area, which just doesn't exist because of our insane trade policies. We have run up this multi-trillion dollar trade deficit. We buy all this junk from low-wage countries. They end up with our dollars. They don't want to buy anything we make, so they come over here and they buy our buildings and whatnot. You can't have a middle class if you don't have manufacturing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.